everyone, and welcome to Creative Psychopaths, a horror movie podcast and the world's premier kitchen for horror sandwiches. What are horror sandwiches, I hear you ask? Well, it's a lovely movie filling surrounded by two slices of chatty goodness. My name's Mark, and as always, I'm joined by Matthew. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Mark.
Hello, how are you this fine day that we're recording?
I'm swell.
Yeah, I didn't want to give away the day we were recording. I feel that would break the mystery of the podcast. I don't want any of that nonsense. I don't know if there's a mystery.
Before you're listening to it, that's when we're recording it.
Oh, yeah, very good. I suppose after would be very difficult.
We're not quite at the level where we can break the space-time continuum, but we're working on it.
Yeah, we're getting there. This week, we're joined by a lovely guest in Vanessa. Hello.
Hi again.
Well, yeah, you're welcome and welcome back, of course. You were here a while ago for Seven. We did Seven.
We did, yeah, that was really good fun. Enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was a good movie, good time, good chat. Which is always a bonus when you're doing a little podcast. Now you're joining us from your own podcast universe, really.
Yes.
The Movie Jewel and the X-Files one that I should have written down the name of and I haven't, but you surely know.
It's a so-called X-Files.
Oh, of course.
That was so-called X-Files club.
Terribly unprofessional of me, though. Terribly unprofessional.
I thought you were just giving the opportunity for Vanessa to plug herself. And
no, I have to hold my hands up to my lack of professionalism. But I'm not a journalist. I never went to school. All I do is make tea for a living. So, I don't know anything.
That's actually true, but not in the way you think.
Yeah, I don't know. Right, well, last time we were here, I was talking about pre-prepared preamble, and it's not it's not that great. I just wanted to, for those people who followed me on Instagram, probably noticed that for my birthday, I got a couple of horror board games. Which were interesting. I dipped into them because another podcast that I listened to was talking about them, and I wondered whether solo board gaming would be a nice way to have a little break from the old phone. And it is. I played Final Girl, which is sort of what it sounds like, which is a completely solo board game. So you buy like a core pack that has got all the dealy bits in it, and then after that you buy videotape, so you can play through different scenarios, and it's good fun. So I would recommend that to any of you out there who are thinking about, oh, I'd like to play board games but I don't have any mates.
The concept of it is alien. It seems bizarre, but at the same time, I guess you get, you know, video games that are solo, so why not a board game?
Yeah, well, essentially you sort of play two rounds. You play as the final girl, which is what you are, and then you play sort of as the killer, you know, and there are different scenarios that you play through as you go through the game. So it's it's good fun.
The obvious next question is: did you survive?
Well, I must admit that I got to the point where I wasn't paying attention enough and packed it away. but that doesn't mean it wasn't good. I was just sort of
never take your eye off the ball when a serial killer's around, Mark.
Well, exactly. But I did also play Alien Escape from Nostromo, which is a multiplayer and single player game, which is actually actually delightful fun. Again, you essentially set up a board game and you pick a character, and each character on the ship has got certain, you know, qualities to them, and then there's the alien, and you sort of you play as both, and it's good fun. You pick from, again, scenarios, so things you have to do before you can escape. And yeah, I really enjoyed that, but I certainly would have liked to have played it with somebody else as well. But yeah, it's not really preamble, this, is it? It's just me chatting about board games.
Yeah, this was an entire slice of bread that we could have used.
Yeah. Well, I realised that, but I also realised that I've come to the end of everything I could say about it.
Well, I have to try and work out a way of playing something as an episode.
That'd be good, wouldn't it? Maybe we could do it over Zoom and record the actual Zoomage. Zoomage, is that a word? I think it might be. It is now. Anyway. Yeah, so not a hilarious preamble, I'll grant you, but you know, if you fancy certainly horror board game and you know a little bit of time to yourself and want a break from your phone, I'd certainly say the Final Girl is worth a go. And it wasn't too bad, it wasn't too pricey either, so there you go. Get into that. Get into it.
For thought, for sure.
Yeah. But anyway, let's get into the first slice of bread. We brought Vanessa back, and of course, everybody knows that returning guests have returning questions. Why not? So we're going to ask you them. There's only a slim four to pick from. But why don't we start with the best opening? Let's open with the best opening. So go on then. What's the best opening?
This is really boring because this is something that I talk about a lot, but I think I'd have to say Scream, the original Scream. The opening scene with Drew Barrymore, I think, is just perfect. It could be a short film in itself. I'll tell you the other one I thought about, but I decided not to go with, was the first Final Destination movie. You know, the opening on the plane. I think that's pretty awesome. But I mean, I think I'm sure I mentioned the last time I was on that Scream is my favourite horror movie. And I just think the opening sequence to Scream is perfect. And I actually saw Scream in the cinema for the first time. I'm trying to think when it was. Was it the 25th? Anniversary, so what would that have been, 2021? Was it 96 it came out?
Yeah, I saw it then as well.
Yeah, and it was so good seeing it in the big screen, because when it first came out, I saw it on like VHS at a sleepover, which is a common theme for where I saw most horror movies, including the one we're going to talk about today. But actually seeing that on the big screen, like with an audience, was just phenomenal. And I just think it's like you could just watch that, as I said, like a short on its own, and it would work. But it's such a clever opening. And obviously when Scream came out, you know, Drew Barrymore's face was on the poster, kind of front and centre. People didn't know that she was going to die so early on in the movie. So I just think, I suppose I could have sat and thought about it longer, but I thought, you know, what's the first thing that comes to mind? And to me, it's the opening scene from Scream.
Yeah, I think we both maybe chose that when we were answering these for ourselves.
It's an obvious answer for a reason, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's the correct one. I'm sure it's the correct answer. If we had those in this situation, but I was watching Scream, again the other day, and it just never really gets old, you know.
No.
Apart when we did the review on it, I recall thinking to myself that I wasn't going to like it because I was sort of starting to get sick of these sort of self-referential sort of things. But then when you go back into it, it still has that originality and it's still great. So yeah, Scream's a really good film. I don't understand why, because there are people who don't like it, and I'll never really understand what the problem is. What's your damn problem? But yeah, no, that's a good one. That's a correct one. Well done.
That's the correct answer.
So let's do the best antagonist and protagonist, since Scream has one of the best protagonists.
So, antagonist. I'm just checking. Antagonist means villain, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, thank God. antagonist, I think I'd have to say Pennywise. Tim Curry's Pennywise. I don't know how I mentioned this the last time I was on the pod, but It by Stephen King is my favourite book. I read it every single year, despite it being like 1,200 pages long. And the original TV miniseries with Tim Curry, I just think Tim Curry's performance is brilliant. I love Tim Curry. I love him in Rocky Horror. I love him in Clue. I love him in Legends. I love him in, what's that, Home Alone 2? But I think Pennywise is just like an iconic, like, even people that don't know horror, if you say Pennywise, it's like Freddy or Jason or Ghostface or Michael Myers. People just know who Pennywise is. And I just think he's a fantastic antagonist. I think he's so good in that movie. But even just as a concept, like in the book, even in the new movies, for Bill Skarsgård, I don't think his performance is as iconic as Tim Curry's. But it's still just a fantastic character because, like the best villains, you don't know where he came from. You don't know why he's doing what he's doing. And that's scarier than these villains where they try and explain it all away. And they've done that with some of the big, you know, in like Rob Zombie's Halloween, they try and give like Michael Myers this like backstory. And to me, that's just pointless because the whole point of these people is they're like monsters. They shouldn't have a backstory. They should just be what they are, and that makes them scarier. And I just think Pennywise as a concept is brilliant, and Tim Curry's performance in the miniseries. And the miniseries I love, although I know it's got a lot of flaws, but I think his performance is one of them. I think it's fantastic.
It's funny you say about reading the book every year, did you say?
I've read it every year since 2016. So I read it for the first time when I was like, oh my God, about 14 or something. It was one of those things that got me into horror. And then I read it again probably like 10 years later. And then in 2016, I actually started writing a book, which I've still not finished. And I was like, I'm going to read that again because it's my favourite book. And I enjoyed it so much, I kind of made a pact for myself to read it every year. And I read it every summer because it's set in the summer. Yeah. So I read it about July, August time. And it takes me like a month to read it because it's so long. And actually, funnily enough, my brother was saying to me that the audiobook's brilliant. It's Steven Weber that does the audiobook. So he's trying to get me, instead of reading it this year, he's like, you should listen to the audiobook because it's really, really well done as well. So I might do that, although that's a slightly different experience. But I suppose I like podcasts. So listening to an audiobook is just like listening to a podcast, but doing it in chunks, I suppose, rather than like just sitting listening to a podcast. But yeah, I read it every year. So what's that been? Like if I do it this year, that's 8 years in the trot, I would have read it. And, you know, last year I was like, you know what? I'm going to read something, another big Steve, because I'm trying to work my way through all the Stephen King books. But I was like, no, I would miss it too much if I don't read that. So I ended up reading that again.
Yeah, I mean, I literally just finished it for the first time.
Wow.
But I can't imagine going back in. I think it was an endurance for me. And then of course I tried to do The Stand, but gave up on it.
I haven't read The Stand yet. It's one of the big ones that I've yet to read. I read Christine last year, I think it was.
Oh yeah, I like that one.
It was good, but it's a tome as well. But The Stand I need to go back to. But I think one of the reasons I like it so much is because the age I read it, I wasn't that much older than the kids in the book.
Right.
So there's probably a heavy dose of nostalgia attached. And I think as much as it's about Pennywise and stuff, to me, it's about friendship and like losing touch with people as you get older and grown older. And
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
There's problematic parts of the book, I know that. But overall, I love it. And I just think Pennywise is such a good villain. And as I said, Tim Curry, I think, just pulls it off so, so well.
Yeah, yeah. I think I was on board with Skarsgård for a while, but having read the book, And I went back into the 90s there. I think actually Tim Curry does capture it probably a little bit better, in fact. He's not quite as creepy as Skarsgård, I'll give you that, but he does seem to capture the spirit of it more. So yeah, no, I'm kind of with you on that one. We just talked there, Matthew. You just listened.
I'm happy to let you go on the roll. That's okay with me.
Do you have a favourite protagonist?
Protagonist would be the good one, the goodie rather than the baddie. Is that right? I'm just I seem to have forgotten in basic English. I could go with Sidney Prescott, right? However, I feel that I've talked a lot about Scream, so instead, I think I'll go with, like, I've got my top kind of top five final girls, and I'll pick another one. So I think I'll go with Sarah Connor.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Just because she's just iconic, and I love Terminator, but I adore Terminator 2, and I think she's just so unhinged but so cool. I
get
just like she's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I like what they did with Sarah Connor. I mean, she starts that first movie as just, you know, sort of anybody, and then, you know, by the end of it she's toughened up. And then when you they do the great thing, I think, in Terminator 2 of actually developing her character sort of off screen. So when you get back around to her, she's like, you know, that soft side of her is gone, and she's just this hardcore, well, nutcase, like you say. But yeah, no, I'd say that's a really good show. Yes, you're a Sarah Connor fan, Matthew. Do you like
yeah, everyone loves Sarah Connor, don't they?
They do, yeah, they do.
I like something that I really love in all media. Is that the concept of foreknowledge of events and how that affects a person? You know, so it's what always fascinated me about Macbeth. You know, it's like the events of the piece probably wouldn't happen if it wasn't for the, you know, the first act, that knowledge that you are going to do this in the future. And I like how Sarah Connor is basically just told that. It's like, you're going to give birth to John Connor, he's going to save the world.
Yeah.
And she's just thrust into this, and every step of the way just grows and grows and grows in, you know, into an ass kicker.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all because she was, you know, someone was sent back in time, and she probably would have just carried on being a happy little waitress if it wasn't for that.
Yeah, very true.
I think it's quite cool, though, that it shows you that somebody that... I mean, I suppose you don't really know much about her backstory, but, like, the fact that you said, like, she is just this kind of waitress, she's not got any, like, military training or anything else, but then she becomes this, like, hardcore badass, and, like, as a woman, I suppose, seeing characters like her, and Ripley from Alien, similar, like, seeing these really tough women... at a time when women weren't portrayed that way in movies as much. Like, so, like, I saw Terminator 2 when I was quite young, and it's like, oh, women can be, look like action heroes. They can, like, kick ass. You know what I mean? I think that's quite empowering when you're, like, a young woman. You'd be like, oh, yeah, that can actually happen.
Awesome. That's really cool. Well, oh, how can I link this in? Oh, Terminator, that's got a great score. What's your favourite score / soundtrack?
So, my favourite horror score, I'm really struggling with this one. Candyman, which we're going to talk about, I think has got an amazing score. I think the score for that's brilliant.
Agree.
The Omen, I think, has a brilliant score. Scream, which I don't want to talk about again, but I do really like the score for that. And the other one that I'll maybe talk about a little bit more is the score to Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
Which is very kind of gothic. A wee bit like The Omen. It's kind of very like overpowering and gothic and over the top. But I think if I had to pick out of all of those ones, I think the score, you know, the music that starts at the start of Bram Stoker's Dracula, it's just, and all the way throughout it. I mean, it's a very over-the-top movie. It's a movie that I love, but it's very over-the-top. And funnily enough, I saw that in the cinema for the first time a couple of years ago as well. It was re-released. And yeah, I think the score is just phenomenal. But there are a lot of horror. I mean, The Shining's got a great score. Halloween obviously has a great score. Like, It's very difficult to try and narrow that one down. It's quite a difficult question, I think.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to pick one.
I think the score is something that gets overlooked, doesn't it, in Dracula? Because it's all, you know, people always talk about the visuals, you know, the costume design, set design, and the fact that Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder got married for real by accident.
That's true, yeah. I didn't know that until recently, which I found really funny. And everybody talks about Keanu Reeves' horrendous accent and not the best acting. But it's a movie that I love. But actually, in the score, funnily enough, I'm recording a podcast soon specifically talking about film scores. So I was actually listening to a few earlier on, and the Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Francis Ford Coppola one, I was like, oh, this is actually really good. And it really helps kind of set the tone of the movie. So I'll pick that one, but all the other ones I spoke about, I think are fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, and actually, I'll throw another one in, 28 Days Later, although I think the music in that has been replicated too many times now. So, like, you've almost got a wee bit bored of it. Like, I'm sure I remember watching The X Factor and the music from 28 Days Later was used for, like, dramatic effect. And I was like, yeah, it's been overused now, I think.
I must admit, I can't remember the music from that.
Oh, can you not? See, if you listen to it straight away, you would recognise, because I'm sure it's been used in, like, adverts and it's been overused a wee bit now, I think. But like when you hear it for the first time, it's actually really good.
So tempted to look it up right
That's
now.
Actually, Danny Boyle season coming in, I think in May, actually.
Saw that. Is it Cineworld?
Cineworld, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. That'll be
interesting. Find out on the big screen.
Awesome.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, I think that they're in Sunshine. It's Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, and 28 Days Later. So lots of good stuff to get in there.
Awesome.
Definitely have to do that. Right, well, the last question is, what's the best remake?
This was kind of tricky, right? Because I think technically The Fly and The Thing are remakes. But I don't know. And actually, the 2017 version of It, some people would say is a remake, but I would say that's just a different interpretation of the source material, because if you think, like, Dracula's been made so many times, but they're not remakes, they're just different interpretation of the book.
Agreed.
So the one I thought I would go for was one that was more like a, and this is probably an answer a lot of people give, but it would be The Ring, the Naomi Watts version. The original, And it's probably a very standard answer that a lot of people give, but the original Japanese Ring, or Ringu, is one of my favourite horror films. I can still remember the first time I saw it and watching the end of that movie and how scared I was. And actually, funnily enough, I have read the book. There was a book that I read a long time ago now. But I don't think the American version is as good as the original, but I think it's a really good film in itself. And I love Naomi Watts. I think she's fantastic. Her performance in Mulholland Drive, I think it's like one of the best performances in a movie I've ever seen ever. And I think it's just a really good remake. And it was a time when there was a lot of American remakes of Asian horror movies.
Yeah.
So like Dark Water, Shutter, which is another movie that I love, the original. Like The Grudge. There was loads of these Japanese movies that Hollywood tried to capitalize. But I think that the best one, in my opinion, would be The Ring. Or was it called Ring? Or is it The Ring? Was it The Ring?
I think it's The Ring.
The Ring, yeah. That's one I'd probably go for. And actually, I rewatched it not too... When I say not too long ago, I mean in the last 5 years. And it stands up. As I said, it's not as good as the original, but it still stands up as a decent horror movie. And I think if you saw it without seeing the original, you would think it was pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. I saw that. I saw that first. I don't think that is a bit become a standard answer, though. I don't. Maybe someone's picked it, but we've had Evil Dead probably more than anything else.
Oh, of course, Evil Dead 2.
No,
the 2013.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Is it the 2013 one?
Yeah, we've had that come up quite a lot. And
Suspiria
has come up a few times.
I've not seen Suspiria. I need to watch Suspiria because I've heard it's good. But the Evil Dead remake, to me, it just doesn't touch the original Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2.
Well, no.
Phenomenal. I just don't think. And I don't mind the remake, but I don't know. It wasn't really for me.
Yeah.
But I do need to check out Suspiria. Suspiria, I love the original Suspiria. And I've heard that the remake does kind of different stuff, which I always think you need to do with the remake because, like, I've seen things like the Omen remake and the Psycho remake, and they're almost just like scene for scene replicas of the original. And it's like, that's completely pointless in my opinion.
Absolutely agreed. I think that's the general consensus on the podcast, or at least Matthew said that, and I agree with him.
I just don't really get what Gus Van Sant was going for with that Psycho thing. I mean, it's this weird idea that does genius exist between the margins and stuff, and can you replicate it? But I think the bottom line is we've already seen it. You know, it's...
Yeah.
That is as simple as that. We've already seen it. So there's no need for the extra. The other one I don't like was the Funny Games remake, which, like, it's fine as a film, but it's just so unnecessary just doing it as a new language, but still shot for shot.
Yeah.
It feels somewhat... bereft creatively.
I've not seen either of the Funny Games movies, actually. They're a bit of a gap in my filmography. I'm trying to think of other remakes. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake was pretty shit. Yeah, a lot of them are just... And I don't know if you've seen that they're remaking... is it Speak No Evil?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And I really, really loved the original Speak No Evil, and I watched the trailer for the remake recently, and James McAvoy's in it, and I like James McAvoy, but the trailer gives away far too much, and James McAvoy is acting like a psychopath, so he's playing like the kind of bad character in it. And I thought the whole point of the original was that you didn't know that he was bad, like, until quite far into the movie, but if you watch the trailer for the new one, it's very obvious that he is. And I was like, yeah, that's... And I don't really see the point in it because it's so soon after the original came out. And to me, it's just, is it just because, like, some people can't be bothered reading subtitles? Like,
well, that is the sad truth of it. You know, that those movies are not... It's not that they're not accessible to a wider audience, but the wider audience won't watch foreign language movies. So when they find something that works... They remake it, but they always lose that part of it.
Definitely.
I can't think there's ever been a foreign language movie made into, you know, English language that's ever really captured the spirit of those movies. And often that's because you know, like, certainly French movies and things like that, they take movies to that extreme level, and they can't push that if they want it in a Hollywood level. So you never really get that total uncomfortableness, you know, like something like Martyrs, for example, which is really, it can be a really hard watch, but, you know, they sort of took out its teeth a little bit in the American one. So yeah, there is a lot of that that's just crap. But I think we are going to talk about the original Speak No Evil when that sort of comes round, and then we'll, because I don't know if Matthew's seen it or not.
I loved it. I mean, I thought the original Speak No Evil. I mean, when I say I loved it, I mean like it completely disturbed me, and I'm not in a hurry to rewatch it. But I think it was very effective about like what it did.
Yeah. Well, we won't say too much about it because I don't. Have you seen it, Matthew? Maybe.
You know, I still haven't. No.
No, fair enough. Well, we'll.
No, like... we're going to cover it. I don't see the point until we do.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah, I think we'll cover it when that remake comes out, because at least then, you know, we won't have to watch the remake. Or maybe we will. Who's to say? Well, maybe we'll do a special episode where we compare original to remake. That'll be interesting, won't it? Thinking on the what is it, on the fly. Anyway, well, there you see, that was lovely. We only had a few questions, but we filled up some time there. Not that that's the idea. Oh dear, I hit this point where I don't really know what to say anymore and just ramble on. So we're going to get into this lovely, delicious filling, which is our movie this week. And we're going to be talking about one of the classic movies, Candyman from 1992, which is directed by Bernard Rose. Screenplay also by Bernard Rose, and based on The Forbidden, which is a Clive Barker short story, I think, part of his Volumes of Blood or something like that.
Yep, it's a short story. I've not read it, but yeah, it's part of Volumes of Blood. And it was set in Liverpool originally.
Oh yes, I remember at some point I did do a Scouse Candyman on here at some point. And I'll probably do it again. Anyway, starring Virginia Madsen as Helen Lyle, Tony Todd as Candyman himself, Xander Berkeley as Trevor, Vanessa Estelle Williams as Anne-Marie McCoy, Cassie Lemons as Bernadette, and lots of other lovely people. But those are our main players really are Helen and Andy Man. Everyone else feels a bit sort of on the edge of it. So you sort of both pre-prepared you for this question. Not that it's a big one, but I'm really interested to find out what subgenre you think that this movie fits into.
Who do you want to go first?
I don't mind. I can explain my reasons. Because originally I had this in my mind, I was like, oh, Candyman's a slasher. But it doesn't feel like it fits that slasher mold in terms of, you know, there's not a really high death count. And also, I don't think you're there for the deaths either, which obviously what slasher movies are for. So it's a difficult one. It's sort of supernatural, but it's also got Dracula vibes. I'm really just curious to what you think. Vanessa, you go.
I think it's, well, basically to me, it's like an urban legend, which makes me think it's more like a folk horror.
Right, yeah.
Obviously, stuff like the Blair Witch Project, I would say, is like a folk horror.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, the iconic folk horrors like The Wicker Man, which isn't really an urban legend type thing. But I would say for me, it either fits in the folk horror genre just because it's this kind of urban legend thing, or to me, it would fit in the ghost genre, because I think Candyman is supposed to be like you said, a supernatural presence. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a slasher because I don't think there are enough. Now, I don't know if we'll get on to mention the 2021 Candyman at some point. I think it's slightly different. But yeah, I think this one is more like he is supposed to be like a ghost or another worldly presence. So for me, it would be somewhere between folk and ghost. unless there was another sub genre for urban legend horror.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is.
No, I'm with you. I was thinking modern folk as well. What do you think, Matthew?
I agree with all of that. Yeah, it's a folk horror movie.
Yeah.
And it's just the folk are, 20th century people.
These are different folk from the other folk.
It is. It takes all of those folk horror beats and sets them in an urban area.
Yeah. I just thought it was an interesting question, really, to see sort of where it comes from. I was telling Vanessa at the beginning, like, I've seen this movie before, but this is the first time I've seen it since the first time I saw it. And it's really taken me aback as to sort of, all the story and stuff like that. And I just don't think I really remembered it as the film it is, or Candyman being the character that he is. This sort of, like I say, there's a sort of Dracula-esque vibe to him, especially looking at some of the sort of backstory of the character. And he seems to have this sort of thrall as well, this sort of thrall over Helen. I just thought it was just a really different film from what I was expecting it to be, or even remembered it being.
That's interesting what you're saying, though, about the Dracula. I hadn't thought about the Dracula thing, but the relationship that him and Helen have, and the fact that he kind of becomes obsessed with her, and to a certain extent, maybe she does with him, but he almost like casts her under his spell kind of thing. You're absolutely right. That's very, very Dracula-esque, and that's a theme or whatever that I hadn't actually thought about. But you're spot on. There is definitely an element there of that.
So, I assume this wasn't anybody's first. Well, it wasn't your first watch, Vanessa. You picked it, and
no. I've seen it not too many times because I love it. You can't see it too many times, but the first time I watched it, as I think I said to you, Mark, before we started recording, was at a sleepover, which is when I first saw Scream, when I first saw Seven, when I first saw The Exorcist. A lot of these movies I saw on VHS with friends in my mum and dad's living room, because my mum and dad's were lunatics that didn't really care what we watched when we were young. And Candyman, I remember watching it in my mum and dad's living room late at night, because I remember after it, we went through to the mirror to see if we could see Candyman.
Playing with fire there.
Did you?
I think we got to four and then we panicked. I don't think we got to five. I mean, bearing in mind, I was like, oh God, what age would I have been at this point? I wouldn't have been when it came out, because when it came out, I was eight. I was definitely older than that. I'm talking about in my teens, so I must have been about 14 or something. Mm-hmm. And then, no, I think we got to four, and then everybody was like, ran out of the bathroom.
I don't believe any of that stuff. I'm not a person who believes in ghosts and stuff like that, but I'm also not looking to push my luck either.
There is an element of that in the film itself, though, isn't there?
Yeah, well, about not pushing the luck. Yeah.
At the beginning, when the two Helen and the colleague at the university, they start doing the Candyman in the mirror, don't they? And I think they get to four, and the colleague abandons it, and Helen goes for the extra one.
Yeah,
and there is that sense of, again, that comes with folk horror, is don't mess with the stuff you don't fully understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but do you not think that Helen's maybe, I don't know, I mean, we'll maybe get on to talk about this, but Helen's marriage, I think they're married.
Yeah.
I don't think is great. Like, he's a complete arsehole. He's obviously sleeping with that student well early on, and well before Helen gets sectioned and all the rest of it. So I don't know if Helen is deep down maybe not very happy, in her life, so she's more likely to kind of play with fire or whatever because of that show. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just don't think she's particularly happy, because even when she walks in on her husband at the end of, like, his lecture or whatever, and the girl, I can't remember her name, who ends up moving in pretty much as soon as Helen's out of the picture, like, it's quite obvious that they're already sleeping with each other. And it's like, is Helen maybe just looking for something else because she's unhappy in her own life? I don't know if that's looking too much into it, but...
I think,
I mean, there's definitely something there, because it's a big part of Clive Barker's thing, isn't it? That you think about Hellraiser as well.
Yeah,
you know, in a lot of ways, both of these films are family dramas, aren't they? And about relationships breaking down and whatnot. So, I mean, he's definitely there, sure.
So, do you think Helen's maybe a little bit like Julia in Hellraiser? I mean, I think Julia. It's a bit of a cow, to be honest. But again, she's not happy in her own life. She's not happy in her relationship. So she starts doing something she shouldn't. And Helen's kind of the same. She's like, but a bit like Hellraiser as well. It's like lifting something that's based in Britain because it's Clive Barker and then like wonking it somewhere in America, which I don't think works in Hellraiser very well, because I think half the time in Hellraiser, you're like, what country is this supposed to be? And I love Hellraiser. Whereas in Candyman, it does actually work, like Peony Green as a kind of set for this does actually work really well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think as well, with going back to the Helen not being happy, she also gets belittled by other academics, doesn't she, about what she's doing. So I think, again, she's willing to push things further in order to outdo them, to get some respect for, you know, for her work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair, actually, because that dinner scene where they're sitting, and I can't remember the guy's name, but the guy with the long hair does very much belittle her and Bernadette. And I think Bernadette's a really good character in this as well. She's kind of forgotten about a little bit. But, like, they are trying to do something that, you know, they think is quite important, and they are very much belittled by, I don't want to say a man, but it's a man that does that. So it does kind of feed into that, like, oh, well, you know, I know more than you do kind of a thing.
Yeah. No.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's generous helpings of smug knobhead, isn't there, in that
yeah,
character?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sorry, that caught me off guard. right, well, so you watched it many years ago. You obviously enjoyed it. What enthralled you most about this movie then? What...
Like, why did I pick it?
Yeah. It's one of your favourites, isn't it? So
it's in my top 10. I think it's a very well-made movie. I think it's got tons of different themes. We've just spoken about the, I don't know if I'd call it misogyny, but this idea of these women trying to do something and these guys like kind of talking them down. But you've also got like race tensions. You've got the fact that Caprini Green is Caprini Green is like the project... you know, these people are forgotten about. Like at one point Helen talks about, you know, one white woman gets attacked and suddenly the police are interested. The police weren't interested when, you know, black people were attacked. So you've got this race thing, you've got the class thing as well. So there's all these different themes in the movie. You've also got a trope that I particularly enjoy, although it infuriates me, of a woman not being believed and being like section. So obviously Helen is trying to tell people about Candyman and she ends up getting sectioned. She ends up getting pumped full of drugs. A little bit like Sarah Connor, actually, funnily enough, who we were talking about earlier. There's like definitely a through line there. And as much as that infuriates me, like that is something that happened. It happened for years and decades that, you know, like it would be like, oh, it's just a hysterical woman.
Mm.
So I think there's so many different things going on in the movie, but even if you take all of that to the side, it's just a really well put together, clever horror movie. And Tony Todd is just incredible. I mean, he's got one of the best voices I think I've ever heard in my entire life. And I think it's just a very well done horror movie. But then, as I said, there's underneath that, there's all these different things that you could talk. Like, I'm sure if you were like a film student or something, there's so many different like essays and stuff you could write about different themes in this movie. Yeah. And I think it's very well acted as well. Like, Tony Todd's obviously fantastic, but Virginia Madsen is incredible in this film. Like, she's so well cast and she's so good at portraying all the different emotions that Helen goes through. And you really feel for her. Like, you really like watching it. You are on her side. Well, I was certainly when I was watching it. Like, I think she's just fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you said. But I don't know if I said this before, but having watched this again, I thought it was really, really great. It was so much different from what I was expecting, as I say, from what I remembered. And it just, like you say, it feels rife with the themes of, you said, as you said, different things you can take from it. It's one of those movies that I've, at least for me this time, I came away, you know, with a lot of different thoughts. Like, you know, to a certain degree, apart from sort of the final sting, really, where it takes us away. But, you know, there are points in it where you do sort of question the Candyman thing and whether, you know, she really is doing stuff herself, because, you know, she is constantly finding herself in these situations. So there is sort of a questioning of whether that exists or not, because we find later in the film there is a man who calls himself Candyman and has a hook, and, you know, and for all intents,
is that the scene in the worst toilet since Trainspotting?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But for all intents and purposes, he's the person who'd been doing the murdering, you know, in that place, you know. So it does start asking questions, I think. But as I say, you know, the sort of, as it goes towards the end, it obviously becomes very, very clear that it is all true. But I like the sort of idea of doubt, and, you know, to a degree there's a bit of mental health in there too. Yeah, what did you think, Matthew? What did you think watching this bad boy?
Yeah, I think I preferred it this time to the first time I watched it. And I think, just to sort of expand on what you guys were saying as well, I don't know if you agree or not, but I guess you probably will after what you've been saying, but this feels so much more modern than all the other films that came out around that time that we've seen.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily say it feels ahead of its time, but it feels, I think, that it's just aged much better.
Yeah.
And I think probably part of that is because of the fact that it's quite vague with a lot of the stuff. You know, like, in terms of Candyman being, you know, he needs his story, he needs the fear to circulate to be powerful or what have you. And it kind of does something similar to, like, Freddy in the first Nightmare on Elm Street film, doesn't it? Where it gives you, like, the idea of where this, you know, what this guy can do, where he gets his power from and whatnot. Whereas Nightmare on Elm Street kind of sets the rules but leaves them a bit of a mess. This film gives you it as not quite setting the rules, so it lets you fill in the gaps. You know, all it really does is do the mirror thing. And even that, it's not entirely consistent even.
You know, so true.
It makes Candyman this character who's just like he kind of just does what he wants for his own ends. And I think that makes the film, it feels like it has that modern sensibility where it plays into sort of the cerebral horror more than stabby, stabby, kill, kill.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I think I had the same thought myself that it doesn't feel like an old film.
The only thing that really ages it is like a lot of these things. It's just like the technology and the fact that everybody smokes. Like, they're the only really things that age it. But actually, I think it, like you said, Matthew, I think it stands up really, really well.
Yeah. I think the talking about some of the film elements, you know, and talking about your questions, I think this film's actually got a really good opening as well. It gives you the sort of Candyman story, you know, as being told and as being shown through a sort of almost, you know, 80s horror movie way of doing things, you know, like, this happened and this happened, you know, and it's a really good opening, you know, told well and is engaging. And yeah, I really liked it. I think it's got a nice opening. And then the fact that it leads into the fact that it's sort of a story being told, which I think we already know anyway, but yeah, I like that. I love that. I like that element of it. I mean, of course, this movie does do something that, you know, is frowned upon all the time, which a dog is killed.
That was not good.
No, you can't go around killing animals. Kill as many humans as you want. We're not bothered about them. But don't be killing dogs.
Totally agree. I wrote that in my notes. Poor doggy. seemed like a nice doggy. Thankfully, you didn't see the dog getting killed.
No, that would have been too.
But actually, even in really harsh films, even in films like Audition, which I rewatched not that long ago, you only see the aftermath, which is bad enough. But actually seeing an animal getting killed, I think, is too much even for us horror fans, because I think a lot of us horror fans are actually big animal lovers. So I think the bit with the dog being killed, it's so well done, because Helen, I think, is in the underpass with Candyman, and she wakes up on the floor of Vanessa Williams' character's apartment, and then she's covered in blood. She's got, like, is it a meat cleaver or something? And then you see the dog's head, and it's just like, oh, holy shit, what's actually happened here? And she's got no idea what's happened. And I think that's when it turns to, oh, this is just a hysterical woman who started killing people, which, as I said, is something that, even though it's, I think, is very frustrating to watch, I do quite enjoy. I quite like that when you see somebody and you're like, no, but she's telling the truth. But then you've got psychiatrists and stuff going, no, we just need to pump her full of drugs or whatever.
Knock her out.
And it is more women that get that treatment in movies than it is men. That's definitely something that you see that you don't see as much. Which I think historically is probably correct, because, you know, that did happen. But it's aged well, I think, because I think a lot of the themes in it are themes that you could apply to stuff today as well.
Yeah, for sure. What else do we want to talk about?
Well, it was mentioned earlier, but let's bring it up again, because the score for this movie is incredible.
Brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels weird being in a horror film, but I love the playful little lilt that Candyman has as a theme. Like, it's so, like, delicate and charming for a character as nasty as that. And The whole thing is just top notch.
Yeah, I think the score's I think the score's fantastic. I think even like right at the start, the bit with all, like you've got all, obviously that cold opening scene with like the babysitter and stuff, which actually doesn't really go with the rest of the movie because that is a bit of a slasher scene at the very start.
Yeah.
But then you've got it going into the music and the bees over Chicago, and yeah, I think the score is fantastic. The other thing I was going to mention was the idea of people's hair turning white from shock because that babysitter's boyfriend, they talk about his hair, and that's something that happens in Bram Stoker's Dracula, which we spoke about earlier. Do either of you guys know
that? That's Dummy's song.
Yeah, is that a real thing, right? I've never Googled this in. Can people's hair just turn white like immediately or overnight with shock? Or is that a thing that we only see in horror movies? Does anybody know?
I don't, but
I've never been aware of it happening.
It's a severe stress could theoretically cause the immune system to cause dark hairs to fall out, leaving just the white ones behind.
Right.
So possibly.
It's also probably worth noting as well that that's horror icon Ted Raimi.
Yes, it was Ted Raimi, yes.
Yeah.
Do we actually see his hair turn white?
No.
They keep mentioning that, but nobody's hair actually turns white. But I suppose that's one.
They just mention it. I just think it's one of these concepts, like, you know, somebody's hair turned white because they were so in shock. It's the same as when you hear these things in horror movies, like somebody saw something and it was so horrifying that they just like dropped down dead. You know, it's one of these things that's like, would that actually happen in real life? Like, would somebody see some like kind of like a Ring or Ringu that we were talking about earlier, where people see something and they like die of shock? Or I think you see it in some that kind of cosmic horror. Oh, I've forgotten the name of the author that does like really cosmic
Lovecraftian
stuff. Yeah, where like you see something that's so horrifying that you just, it's the same kind of idea. You see something that's so scary that your hair turns white, or like you have a stroke or something. Like these are kind of tropes that you see in horror movies that I actually really enjoy for some reason. Because just the idea that you could see something that's so scary that it would have like a physical effect on you, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just something as well that gives a very, a very easy to imagine, an easy to execute way of conveying a severe reaction to something as well. It's just like,
yeah,
it's wonderful in its simplicity.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one of the things to talk about is really the sort of, you know, there's this also storyline of the baby having been kidnapped by Candyman, and then, you know, we sort of get this scene towards the end where he's got the baby in a bonfire, and it's to lure Ellen in there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty horrific, but I think it works because ultimately Helen saves the baby, which is why when you have that funeral scene at the end and there's like two people at her funeral, and then you see all the people from Cabrini Green turning up, because I think they know that she wasn't actually bad. She was a victim of Candyman, and she was trying to save baby Anthony. And I don't know if you want to touch on the 2021 Candyman at all.
I'm happy to.
Have you guys both seen it?
Yeah. I think watching this again made me enjoy that film more, looking back.
Yeah.
Yeah, agree.
Same as this one.
Yeah. Do you know that it's Vanessa Williams playing the same character?
I didn't remember that, but when I did check on IMDb, I did notice that.
Which is unreal because she looks incredible. She does not look like she's aged as much as she should have done in that space of time.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But
that's
no, I
the...
think the...
Sorry.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think that the 20, 2021, 22,
Yeah,
does a really good
it was
version.
21, yeah.
Yeah, it does a really good job of pushing those folk ideas further as well. It takes it forward in that it's not, it's not just about the stories that scare people and hold people down and allow people to blame the problems on. But it like moves it into the commodification of those stories, which is kind of, I mean, it's kind of what we do as horror movies, isn't it? People turn our fears and our societal worries and make money out of it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it was quite fascinating as a film in and of itself, and should probably go through and watch them all again, really.
Yeah. No, I'm with what you said before, the watching this again made me appreciate that movie more. And I really enjoyed the 2021 version. I didn't know what I was expecting going into that one because I thought it was a remake, but it was just a really well-made sequel. Very good. Because I understand the sequels to this particular movie, the second, and I think there might be a third one, are not up to much, which is a shame, really, because it's such a good film, with other things to explore, that it's a shame that they haven't gone on to be so good.
I've never
Yeah.
seen the sequels apart from the 2021 Candyman, and
Yeah.
I suppose I've got quite a lot of love for it because it was one of the first films I saw in the cinema kind of post-pandemic, and it had been postponed, I think, because of the pandemic. It's also the film that kind of got me into the Evolution of Horror podcast. And without that podcast, I wouldn't be doing this today, I suppose. But I think when you see the two of them, it is a very clever sequel. Like you said, it leads into the folk horror stuff, Matthew. Like it's got that bit there. It has got this kind of through line, and I think it works really well. Although I do think it has more slasher. There's a couple of, to me, scenes that I'm almost like, was that added just to make it more like a slasher? Rather than, because the most interesting story in the sequel is Anthony's story, but I do think that the 2021 it's not as good as the original, but I think it's a really good film in its own right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, have you got much more you want to say about it, or shall I move on to the Facebook comments?
I think I'm happy myself.
I'm happy. I just wanted to say, I think my favorite line in the movie is when Candyman says, and this is repeated in the 2021, it's when he says, "I am the writing on the wall. I am the whisper in the classroom." I think that's a very good line, and it is repeated in the 2021. I can't
Yeah.
say it in Tony Todd's voice because Tony Todd has an iconic voice, but I think some of the stuff Tony Todd says is brilliant.
Yeah, well, probably it. I don't know whether it would have worked in the Scouse accent
Probably not.
back in the day.
Well, I'm right in thinking that it was an Irish character in the novel. It
What's
was
that?
set in Liverpool, but based on Irish violence.
Potentially,
Violence
because
against
there's.
the Irish, to be specific.
That would make sense if it was Liverpool. Yeah, I've not read it. I need to read more Clive Barker, I think.
Yeah, there's no point in me doing a Scouse candy. I'm going to do it anyway. I'm the writing on the wall. I'm the whisper in the classroom.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. Yeah, not bad.
Oh, thank you very much. Right, well, let's have a look then. Comments, Facebook, what did people say? Vincent said, a suffusive, seductive, suspenseful, and sanguinary blend of ghost, folk, and slasher horror that ingeniously interweaves the supernatural and the sociological. Yeah?
Involving or causing much bloodshed.
Good stuff. I met Vincent at Glasgow Fright Fest. in March.
Oh, did you?
That is Vincent Endgame.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've spoken to him online a couple of times, but yeah, I was at Glasgow Fright Fest in March and I actually met Vincent in real life.
Yeah, well, we had him on the podcast and he was a fascinating bloke to speak to. Absolutely fascinating.
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Alistair, I have a lot of thoughts. Tony Todd is
another fascinating person to speak to.
Absolutely. Every guest we have is fascinating. I have a lot of thoughts. Tony Todd is magnetic in this role, just oozes charisma and carnage, sexy and spooky. It's bloody and violent, but the scares come from the haunting, lingering poverty and racism that transcends the ghost story. Candyman doesn't appear if you say his name five times in the mirror. It happens when Hal disproves his existence with the arrest of the gang leader. Then he appears. She stopped his name from meaning anything, so he comes to remind people that he exists. The music from Philip Glass is one of the most underrated horror scores ever. Melodic, skin-crawling, it's beautiful. Virginia Madsen has never been better and looks stunning. She went through hypnosis to get into the dreamlike state in the movie. She's a horror icon that should be lauded with the best. It's not without its flaws, but this movie scared me as a child and enthralls me as an adult. One of my favorite horror movies of all time, needs to be watched five times. Oh, I see. Pretty clever. wait, he did have a lot of thoughts. Good.
He summed it up better than we did, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, everybody does down there. That's why we go to these Facebook comments, so people can just sort of skip along and listen to that instead. No, they don't. We were wonderful. I thought we were great. Well, so let's drop our review, although I'd guess it's going to be Creative Psychopaths all round, to be honest.
Yes, for me.
Yeah, I think this time I've been swung round to that, for sure.
Yeah, okay. And yeah, and me too. Yeah, so lovely. Creative Psychopaths all around. I actually think that I could potentially consider putting this in my top 10. I might have to budge something out.
Well, the score has certainly jumped into my top 10 scores.
Well, the score's brilliant.
Yeah, amazing. I think that's a nailed on prize I can give the film.
Yeah, I feel like actually what I feel like there's some really good shots in the film. You know, like overhead stuff. That I'm pretty sure the director was actually doing from a helicopter.
Yeah,
which feels really good. I mean, yeah. Anyway, so it's shot well too. Right. So let's get out of it, and then let's get into this second slice of bread. But before that, don't forget, everyone, visit the social medias, Facebook, Instagram, and if you've got time, please do a rating and review of the podcast, because it really helps us get seen. And of course, if you want a guest, send a message on any of the social medias, or you can email creativepsychopathspod@gmail.com. Right, well, let's get into this second slice of bread. So we're going to be celebrating your podcast here, Vanessa. We're going to be celebrating the so-called X-Files by talking about a horror film that we think Mulder and Scully could investigate.
I think there's several. However, I will come down on Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So one of my favourite X-Files episodes. Are you guys X-Files fans?
I've seen very little. To me, the definitive version of the X-Files is that one episode of The Simpsons.
All right, okay. Well, we're hopefully going to cover that at some point, actually.
But if you ever need a guest, I can do that one.
All right, cool. Good to know. We'll be in touch. The X-Files episode that I think is the scariest X-Files episode is an X-Files episode called Home. I think it's season 4, and there are very, very Texas Chainsaw vibes in Home. It's about this inbred family who kill and eat and maim people. So I think Mulder and Scully could investigate the family in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I think that would be a really good X-Files episode. They could find out who is Leatherface, who are the... I mean, see, when you watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I mean, it's one of my favourite horror movies, like, you don't even know the connect, like, who's the dad, who's the brother, are they all, you know, they're all inbred, they could all be, you know, uncle, dad. But I think Mulder and Scully have had that experience in Home, where they've investigated this weird inbred family, and the town that it's in is called Home. I don't know if it is in Texas, but it's somewhere in the South in America. But I think bringing Mulder and Scully in, and maybe the aftermath of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, would be a phenomenal episode. I mean, see, to be honest, Mulder and Scully are amazing. They could investigate anything. They could investigate Ghostface, Michael Myers, Freddy, Jason, The Shining, like any horror movie you could think of, but I'll come down on Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never seen another X-Files episode and you're a horror fan, you can watch Home, which I am 90% positive is season 4, but you could watch it in isolation without really knowing anything about the X-Files and you would still enjoy it. Like, the X-Files is kind of split between Monster of the Week episodes and mythology. So the mythology episodes all have like a through line, but the Monster of the Week are basically just Mulder and Scully away to investigate something that's supernatural or something that's like a werewolf thing or a vampire thing. Or the episode that we released recently was called Ice, which is very similar to The Thing. It's like a Arctic thing where they find these aliens in the ice. And Home is definitely one that you could just watch by itself. And if you were a horror fan, you would see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibes, and I think you'd really enjoy it. So that's what I'll come down on.
Looks like.
So there you go.
Did you choose one, Matthew? Did you have one?
Yeah, I want to see Mulder and Scully come across those monsters in The Descent.
Oh, that would be phenomenal.
Ye└└└└└└└└└└└└└└============                guy Yeah, let's make David Duchovny go spelunky.
Do you know, to me, the scariest part of The Descent is that bit where she's stuck in that blooming tunnel. That's horrifying.
Yeah, the claustrophobia bit.
Yeah, because that's what I think, because I am claustrophobic and I've got this insane fear of being buried alive. That to me, the scariest part of The Descent isn't the monsters, it's these horrible small species that they're in. And also that idiot woman that's in it that doesn't bring the map. I'll stop, because I could rant for a while about The Descent. Great movie, but it annoys me.
Yeah, Mulder and Scully down there, one of them going, oh, there's monsters down here, and the other one going, don't be stupid, there's no monsters.
There is monsters.
But why are we in this cave?
Piss off.
You don't.
And then hopefully Mulder would take his top off at some point, and maybe Scully. I'll stop talking.
No, I get enough of this at home. My other half loves Gillian Anderson more than she loves me.
Well, that's a fair thing. I mean, I don't know if you saw her recently.
Oh, ow.
Was it the Golden? She was at some awards ceremony recently, and I'm like, she's aging in reverse. Like, I've been rewatching X-Files from the start for the podcast that me and Peter are doing, and she actually looks even better now than she looked way back then. And she's like 52 or something. It's insane. So I'm sorry, Matthew, but I'm with your other half.
Yeah,
I don't mind it from you, Vanessa. You know, we don't share a mortgage, but
my husband's used to it as well. I gush over Gillian Anderson fairly regularly, so she's epic.
No, it seems very fair. I think like you say, she's aging in reverse.
She is. It's very unfair, but she's awesome.
She always seems so nice as well. What?
That's what? Another thing, because I follow her on Instagram and I watch a lot of stuff that she's in. She just seems like a lovely person and fun, and she's a wee bit cheeky, and yeah, she's just phenomenal.
Yeah. I think maybe I don't like her then. Who does she think she is? Well, look how nice I am. Look how pretty I am. Oh, so what? I could be nice and pretty if I tried. only if I tried. I don't try. I prefer to be ugly and grumpy. Not ugly, but just boring looking, really. I've gone off. Anyway, I've chosen Piranha. I wanted to investigate Piranha. I think it would be fun to go to that facility where they get unleashed from. Look, there should have been something here. I think they've been using chemicals of some sort. And then, you know, fish. Killer fish. That feels like a Freak of the Week sort of episode.
It does.
Yeah, killer fish. And then, you know, you get them on a boat with a guide and stuff, so the guide can die and, you know, killer can get a few people killed off while they investigate fish. I want to see Piranha again. But yeah, that's why I watched X-Files back in the day. I think I got up to about season 3 or 4 and sort of started, you know, losing interest. Although that's sort of me to a T, really. I don't think I've only ever watched Buffy all the way through and Breaking Bad, and then most TV shows I just lose interest. So
I would say if you ever think about rewatching it 1 to 7, I would say after 7, I don't know if I would bother so much, but 1 to 7. But then Breaking Bad's Vince Gilligan, who was a writer on The X-Files, so.
Right. I must admit, I have thought about re-watching it and going through your podcast episodes.
You should.
Because I think it's on Disney Plus, maybe.
It is. It's all the entire X-Files, including the movies, I think, are on Disney Plus. So yes, I would say do that and listen to the podcast, because I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Like everything else from that era, like, some stuff doesn't age as well, the technology, the way they dress, but a lot of it I think ages really well. And they're like maybe like 45 minutes an episode, because obviously when you're watching them now, they don't have adverts, whereas when they're originally released. So I would say, and if you can't be arsed watching them all, and you just want a list of good ones to watch, I can give you a list of the kind of Monster of the Week ones, if you can't be bothered with the mythology, that you can just watch in isolation. And some of them are fantastic. I mean, it's my favourite TV show, so I'm probably very biased, but there are some that I've shown, like my mum and dad, for instance, I've never seen X-Files, and I showed them like 2 standalone episodes, 2 of my favourites, and they were like, yeah, they were really, really, really good pieces of television, and they both love Breaking Bad as well. And like I said, Vince Gilligan was a writer on The X-Files. That's where he started.
Okay. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to commit to it. Why not?
Fab.
So you've got this podcast that you do with your movie jewel fella. Peter's always here. He's always on this podcast.
Yes, Peter... Movie Jewel's his podcast, but there's 4 of us that regularly kind of guest on a kind of rotational basis.
Yeah.
So I'm on Movie Jewel probably maybe every couple of months, and then Peter and I have started the so-called X-Files podcast, which is released every fortnight on everywhere you get your pods. We've started having guests on, so if you do start watching and you fancy coming along to talk about something, you're more than welcome to get in touch and be involved in that as well.
Lovely. Well, there you go, everyone. I think you should go along and listen to the so-called X-Files. I think we could all manage 1 episode every fortnight. Work your way through the X-Files. I'm going to commit to that now. Go listen to it. And think about what movies you'd like Mulder and Scully to investigate. That's something I've never done before. I don't normally encourage people to do stuff. Anyway, let's go because I can feel I'm starting to lose the thread of everything. So all the links and everything will be in the what is it? The description to those podcasts.
Show notes.
Well done.
Yay.
I'm glad someone around here knows how to podcast.
Just hopping in with a last minute contribution to be quiet for a bit.
Are you going to commit to an X-Files episode every fortnight?
I've already committed.
Lovely. All right. Well,
I mean, I don't really know what's going on most of the time, but it's nice to listen.
Oh, you could listen to that song. That Catatonia?
Catatonia.
Yeah, listen to that song. It's a good song.
Yeah, good song.
Yeah, anyway, let's go. Right, bye, everybody.
Toodaloo.
Thanks, bye.